This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action today. So is the president. The president's going to be meeting with the president of the Prime Minister of Australia. They're going to have a bilateral lunch together and talk about nuclear submarines and some other things. For example, Australia could divorce themselves a little bit more from China. That would certainly help us and alert us to the dangers that Taiwan is facing. That should be newsworthy. And, of course, they'll meet with the press as usual. And that always makes news. And, of course, we'll take your calls today. This hour, we're going to be joined by Steve Hilton, the Republican gubernatorial candidate. The Katie Porter revelations, the fact that, he's among the top three now, and he's got to be in the top two if he wants to get to the finals. The fact that he's the top three as a MAGA Republican, kind of interesting. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're going to go to San Francisco. The difference is I think they want us in San Francisco. San Francisco was truly one of the great cities of the world. And then 15 years ago, it went wrong. Yep. It went woke.
Next stop, San Francisco. Trump has decided, after the success in Memphis and D.C., Chicago and Portland to a degree, he'll bring his law enforcement team to San Fran. Will it finally clean up the city? Will they open up their arms or fold them? We're going to look at how these major cities seem to be cooking the books, though, on the crime stats they say are going down.
Number two.
He has a very narrow path to winning this race because what New Yorkers saw is the fact that it's more of the same with Andrew Cuomo. It's more of the same with the affordability crisis. It's more of the same with the style of politics.
That's it. Mayor Mamdani, should we get used to that word, that phrase, that title? I hope not. Cuomo and Sliwa have just 2 weeks to massively change things, and they can't do it with both in the race. Plus, which New Jersey and Virginia, New Jersey and Virginia, both the blue states, are tightening for the Republicans?
Number one.
I heard the president asked you what the chances were for success.
Yes.
And you said?
100%. And he said, why do you feel so confident?
Yeah.
And I said, well, we can't afford to fail.
That is Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner on 60 Minutes last night, mysteriously sitting down with Leslie Stahl, who lit up the president, remember, and just flat out treated him terribly while not even acknowledging that the laptop was real and the Russian hoax was a hoax. Well, they sat down and they had a revealing interview, told the president when he asked if they could get a deal done, he actually says yes. But meanwhile, we'll give you the latest on Gaza today, as well as Ukraine. They're both their path to peace and the stakes and absolute latest in both war zones. I'll give you my take on the path to peace. First off, when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, this is what the president should do. He should say, hey, Senate, 85 of you want massive sanctions and secondary sanctions in place on Russia. Get me that signed piece of legislation, and I want to leave it on my desk. And then I want the Tomahawks. I want them delivered to Ukraine. But Ukraine, Zelensky, do not touch them unless we get something out of the Budapest meeting. So if the Budapest meeting goes like Alaska, where Vladimir Putin wants to give the history of Russia and how Ukraine is not a real country, stop it, get up and leave. Sign that piece of legislation, massive sanctions on Russia, and tell them to launch the Tomahawks when they're ready. And that's what I would do. And the only thing that they understand with Russia understands is pressure and military pressure, especially. The sanctions will work even more, but I think their economy's sucking wind. I think their energy sector's been really hurt. And I think the people buying gas and oil from them need to pay a price, including China. And the other thing is, the president thinks according to reports, he thinks the Ukrainians are losing. And I just don't think that's the case. Everything I read, the people I talk to, they're not losing this war. The Financial Times writes this: the meeting between the U.S. and Ukrainian presidents descended on Friday many times into a shouting match, with Trump cursing all the time, people familiar with the matter said, according to the report. Now, what Putin wants is Donetsk. But they haven't won Donetsk. They had 14 years. They can't. And if you give up Donetsk, there's a pathway right to Kyiv. So one day, a few years or 3 years after Trump leaves, the new person gets in there. They take their eye off the ball and goodbye, Kyiv. then what's it all worth it for? Here's President Trump. Cut to.
I've been asked by Ukraine if they could have tomahawks. And I'm looking at it. I spoke with Vladimir Putin about it. Not that he would be thrilled. It's a violent, vicious weapon. But we have to remember one thing. We need them for ourselves, too. You know, we can't give all of our weapons to Ukraine. We just can't do that. And I've been very good to President Zelensky and to Ukraine, but we can't give, you know, if we're going to be short, I don't want to do that. I can't jeopardize the United States.
We could give a dozen, no problem, but we know that. And it's not a matter of being short, and we could just mass produce them. I didn't even know they were land-based. I always thought they had to be shot off a ship, but I guess that's wrong. But the one thing the president, I think, has wrong is that Vladimir Putin can win this war. They're not. They can't win the war. If they could have won the war, they would have done it 3 years ago. Cut four.
We are not losing this war, and Putin is not winning. And really, his army now in the weak position, I think so, because they really, from the beginning of this war, they could occupy 1% of our land.
Look,
but
the president has done an incredible job bringing the Republicans and Democrats to compliment him, what him and his team have done in Gaza. Even as you work your way forward, and we'll go over that there's obviously two IDF soldiers died yesterday, and in return, the IDF hit back and wiped out at least 14 Palestinian militants and blew up some tunnels where they popped out of over in the Rafah area. But clearly the other thing that would bring Republicans and Democrats together, majority of Republicans and Democrats believe the president should do everything. Not the Rand Pauls and the Bernie Sanders, they never believe it. But here's Mark Kelly. Cut 10.
Putin does not want Ukraine to get a longer-range missile that could go after targets deep into Russia, beyond Moscow and St. Petersburg, by the way. It can range targets much further. It's very accurate. It's a very survivable weapon. And Putin has a conversation with him, and those weapons are now off the table. Hey, I think Ukraine can handle, if we can give them enough rounds, if we have them in our inventory, and enough launchers, ground launchers are rather new to this system, something we got rid of for a long period of time. They've demonstrated their ability to operate a sophisticated weapon system like the F-16. They could handle this, and it would help.
So that Senator Mark Kelly would fully back him. The guy is, he's got this great military background. He's more of a politician than I ever thought. But here, I think he would honestly say, I have to sign on to this. I mean, it would definitely work. And the bottom line is, every day that Russia is gummed up and pays a price, it works for us. Because Russia is our enemy. An enemy that has no interest in working with us, unless they're forced to. And when China backing them up and being they're willing to admit they're the junior partner, they have an ally there. So whether you like it or not, every day that Russia fights and Ukraine holds them account, it works for us because they get weaker. As well as we've tied out our Western systems, what they've developed in drone technology, evidently by December, January, they're going to be able to start taking down on a regular basis most of that Shahid drone program that the Iranians gave the patent to the Russians so they could make their own. Well, soon that force field's going to go up. Now, they always make adjustments in this, but you'll be able to stop most of the drones from getting through, as well as what they're losing on the ground. And if we amp it up and we sprint when the other guy's gassed, you could actually win this race. Meanwhile, going over to Gaza over the weekend, two IDF soldiers were killed, sadly, just by standing on their post during the ceasefire. So why? These soldiers were killed when these Palestinian militants attacked the forces operating in the area. The IDF is allowed to be under the ceasefire agreement. The deaths prompted a strong response. They lost 14, as I mentioned. Israel still controls about half of Gaza, as you know. They've accused Hamas fighters of operating out of the tunnels beneath the areas. Now, the Hamas said, yeah, we lost contact with Hamas fighters in Rafah. Who knows if you believe it? I don't believe anything they say. J.D. Vance is going in the area. If this is going to work, there's got to be vigilance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It can't be the president, maybe even not the vice president. Put Michael Waltz in there. But immediately after both sides took aim at each other, they went right back to the ceasefire. And I love that. They don't want to disappoint the president because they know there's nothing good about that. Here's Michael Leiter, an Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Cut 21.
They committed to turning over our hostages. Now, we still have 16 bodies. I mean, they're keeping bodies of the people they killed. Even the mafia remembers where they keep the bodies of the people they bump off. These people have 16 of our citizens that they're holding on to, and they're not releasing them. And under the agreement, they were supposed to give us all the living and dead hostages in 72 hours. That's long gone. So we're waiting for that to happen. We cannot move into the second phase until all of our hostages are released. We have great faith in the negotiating capabilities of Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. They're doing an incredible job, and there's a lot of hope here. But again, we are dealing with a very, very bloody terrorist organization that has no moral scruples whatsoever.
Well, we understand that, and that's why you got to get an international force in there, a force that they're afraid to kill and that's willing to do things. Evidently, there's training going on with in Jordan and in Egypt. It's going to be a mix of those countries, MPs, their version of MPs, and Palestinians that are training with them. And let's see. You know, we recognized the tribes during the surge, and we armed them and backed them. Now they use the term clans over in Gaza. The IDF armed them, and we assume to a degree backed them. Are they going to do that now? Are they going to say, look, we'll give you control of Gaza. We're going to give you the armaments. We need you to no longer be an enemy of the Israeli state. And maybe we reckon, so these clans got to survive. Evidently, they've taken over one area, and they told Hamas, basically, you could try coming in here, we're going to kill you. So I think that that's going to be the key. You train up the security forces and then recognize the groups within the Palestinian territories that they can work with. At the same time, be able to get big earth movers in there and approach the rebuilding of Gaza like it was an earthquake, a hurricane, and a tsunami all at once. But you can't do that while they're shooting at you. We'll talk about that, the New York City mayor's race, what's happening over in Virginia with that race. All of them are tightening up, very intriguing. Bottom of the hour, Steve Hilton. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show on a Monday.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
There's an interdependence between the U.S. economy and China, so something's going to have to get worked out. But there's also outstanding issues since 2000 that China has not resolved. They don't abide by the rules of the World Trade Organization that they're a member of. There's all kinds of trade disputes in Germany, France, United States, Canada, of IP theft. There's the TikTok deal. Let's not forget about that. That's probably going to go sideways for a while. It's one big package, Trey, one big package. And, you know, when you throw out the rare earth stuff and you start with that, that's just the beginning. It's the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. There's so much work to be done here. But both leaders have to do this dance, and that's the nature of it. There will be a deal. I guarantee you that.
Maybe, if China wants it. I mean, I thought we were on the path to doing that. I saw that we showed up in London with a delegation of maybe 10. They showed up with about 30. They were getting into the technical parts of a trade deal with us, and then I thought we would debate the wisdom of it. And then President Xi, I think the President Trump is going to meet with President Xi on the sidelines of a conference next week. So I don't understand how someone would on their side goes, we are going to limit rare earth deliveries to America. Now, I talked to people last week who would know and said that within 18 months, between going around the world mining and refining the rare earth and the metals that we need, we could be out of the woods and not dependent in 18 months. But they might have known that and said, why don't we act now? There's another theory, believe it or not, that President Xi didn't know that they were going to come out last week and say we're going to slow down deliveries or cut off deliveries of rare earth while not buying our soybeans, which matters so much to our farmers in North Dakota, farmers in Iowa. They even brought up in Oklahoma. So here's Tom Cotton on what else we're doing. And that is, he's noticing the research and development at our colleges. There's a huge Chinese presence, and they're stealing. They almost have to. In 2018, they passed a law in China that said that you basically have to work for the government or your family's going to pay the price. So if you're a 26-year-old lab technician and you're working over in Harvard doing innovative things with biotech, and China goes, yeah, we need you to bring some of that stuff back, you got to say yes, because you know who's back there? China. Here's Tom Cotton, what he told me on One Nation over the weekend, Cut 45.
We don't want Chinese nationals coming to our universities and then taking technology back that's going to help them in their competition against the United States, whether they do so willingly or whether they do so because the Chinese Communist Party coerces them through force or through pressure on their families. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to cut off this pipeline to our universities. There's other things that we need to do as well, Brian. You know, our national laboratories, places like Los Alamos or Sandia that are doing critical work on nuclear weapons or quantum computing, still have Chinese, Russian, and even Iranian nationals visiting them. We need to cut that off as well. A lot of these scientific institutions at our universities, at our national labs, have great science. They frankly don't have a lot of hard-nosed common sense about security.
All right, the other thing, KJP has a book coming out. Now, we're not going to buy it. I am curious about what's in it. And evidently, the reason she's leaving the Democratic Party is because of loyalty to Joe Biden, and she's mad at the party for abandoning Joe Biden. I sadly, over the weekend, I saw Joe Biden. We all did. And he looks 111 years old. He's going through chemo treatment. It beats up a 22-year-old has trouble after chemo. This guy is so beat up in particular. There's no way he could have gotten through it. We find out he had prostate cancer. Maybe it was kept from her. But obviously, if you've seen Joe Biden and then you blame the party for the fact that they abandoned him, instead of using your head and saying there's no way this guy can do the job, because you must have seen him up close. But instead, she says she can't stomach being a Democrat after the party's treatment of Joe Biden. And my goodness, what is wrong with you? Are you that blindly loyal to him? You know, I could understand that. But you know that he wasn't briefing you. You know he wasn't doing the job more than 4 hours. You know nobody said he's done even more. You know the reason, one of the main reasons that you did at your press conference were absolutely useless to any member of the press, because you had nothing to say. And now we find out one of the reasons you had nothing to say is because there was nothing going on. You weren't being briefed by the president. You didn't have one-on-one time with the president. You heard about some of the advisors said they met with him once every 6 months. One guy was there for 2 years, met with him one time. So now, an excerpt from her book, she says, Biden seemed to be at total peace with his decision to drop out. She said, I was stunned. My feelings were a blur. I was angry and sad. I was enraged and heartbroken that this man who had given more than 50 years of his life to serving the American people, and in the end, he'd be treated so poorly by members of his own party. It was horrible. What do you think about that? 1-866-408-7669. I'm going to talk a little about California's governor's race and San Francisco and putting the security forces in there. That's where Trump's going next. But I do want to hear what you have to say. I mean, how do you feel about somebody up close actually mad at the party for stepping in on Joe Biden, knowing he hadn't been able to do the job for at least 2, maybe 3 years, if at all? And she actually, she's taking a heroic stand. I don't know how she expects to do a book tour. But then again, I was a little surprised. I don't know how Kamala Harris is going to do a book tour. All right, so we're going to come back with Steve Hilton, then take your calls. Thanks for listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. It gives me great pleasure to tell you that Simply Safe is now available at 50% off because you're listening to this podcast. So go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Now, why is Simply Safe so perfect? Number one, it's easily put in. Number two, it's unbelievably effective. Number three, they're using AI now to stop the break-in, not just catch the people that are doing it, but to stop them before they infiltrate your life and destroy your personal property. I personally trust these people. This is a game changer. The agents take action while the intruder is still on the outside. They confront the intruder, letting them know they're being watched on camera, and you know they're going to head for the hills because they're going to head right to prison if they don't, and hopefully they still will. There are no long-term contracts. There are no hidden fees. Get this, the U.S. News and World Report, they named them, SimpliSafe, the best home security system. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what price can you put on safety? Well, SimpliSafe is easy to install. They're always improving the product, and it's affordable. Why can't you be safe? The answer is, of course you can. Go get SimpliSafe. Save your 50% by going to SimpliSafe.com/Brian. Get it.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're going to go to San Francisco. The difference is I think they want us in San Francisco. San Francisco was truly one of the great cities of the world. And then 15 years ago, it went wrong. It went woke.
That is true. But the challenge is in San Francisco is going to be the mayor is actually better, doing a lot of positive things than what's her name, London Breed. And they're actually making some gains. It's a moderate. And the San Jose mayor, they say, is a moderate. I mean, that could have hope. Now, my hope is that this mayor in San Francisco, okay, I'll take the help. I'll take the FBI. I'll take more, and I'll take more National Guard. Anything to help me crack down, federal troops or federal officers, that would help. ATF, Border Patrol, we know the border's been wide open. I doubt it, though, because of Gavin Newsom running for president. He wants to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't make any gains in California, which means California doesn't make any gains. He says if Donald Trump sends troops or forces into San Francisco, he will ruin the city. If anybody knows how to ruin San Francisco, it would be the former mayor. Who knows how to ruin a state, it would be the soon-to-be former governor. Steve Hilton joins us now, Republican gubernatorial candidate, and serves as director of strategy for the British Prime Minister, David Cameron. And author of Califailure, Reversing the Ruin of America's Worst Run State. Steve, welcome.
Great to be with you, Brian. I mean, it's a serious situation. And you're right about Daniel Urie, the mayor of San Francisco, to a certain extent. He's a friend of mine, by the way. I've known him for over 10 years. He's doing his best, but he's not confronting the structural issues that are a disaster in San Francisco. And so you still have a very, very serious problem, which is that San Francisco is overrun with international drug gangs. That is the key point people have to understand. You have between, at any particular time, and this is coming directly from a guy called Tom Wolfe, who I spent a lot of time with, who's a recovering addict, who's now an incredibly effective voice for what's going on the streets of San Francisco. I was on the second day of my campaign, I was there with him. And he was showing me around, and I keep in touch with him on this, up to between 500 and 1,000 organized international drug fentanyl dealers on the streets, unimpeded, open-air drug markets. And this has been going on for a decade or more. And by the way, they're nearly all from Honduras. There's even a town in Honduras, in the Siria Valley, it's called, Siria Valley in Honduras, which is basically funded by the drug profits from San Francisco to the extent that the houses there, they will have 49ers flags up and they will love San Francisco. This is a situation that is not being got under control. And it's true that the current mayor is doing a little bit better. You've got a bit of cleanup going on. But even there with the move, with the homelessness, for example, I was there on the street in the Tenderloin and they say, yeah, this is better than it used to be a few weeks ago. The police come in, move the homeless people on. They send them to the city's triage center, and I said, what happens after that? Oh, they come. Yeah, that closes at 7 p.m. They're back on the streets. You come here at night, it's a war zone again. They're not really dealing with the problem. Final point, I would add that Matt Mahan, the mayor of San Jose, who I also know less well as a friend, but I know him, he really is the one who's stepping up and challenging Gavin Newsom, constantly calling him out. But in San Francisco, the mayor is not welcoming any federal help at all. He's literally saying nothing. He's trying to avoid the issue. And then you've got others in San Francisco, the DA, Brooke Jenkins. She has threatened to arrest federal law enforcement, arrest them. That's her response. And then you've got the Board of Supervisors united against this. So there's no sense in which San Francisco is welcoming help or support, which is exactly what they should
do. Here's Gavin Newsom. Newsom, cut 34.
This president appears unhinged, unmoored by reality and facts. Seems listless. He seems, dare I say, in decline cognitively. And these are just rantings of someone that needs an intervention, needs some help.
So a couple of things. If there's anyone who is not listless on the planet, it is Donald Trump. 20 hours a day, every moment, every issue, as a micromanager in the Washington Post today, it is working. So for him to say that is like saying he's not 6'3". I mean, what's he doing there? Like, why is it? And Pritzker says the same thing. Is this a concerted effort to make people think that Joe Biden didn't lose? I don't know what their approach to this is.
Brian, it's so pathetic, honestly. I mean, he could have been talking about himself, the person who's unhinged and just really losing it and seems, I mean, you look at it, you can see it in his eyes. There's something wrong with Gavin Newsom. There really is. And I don't say that with any joy. It's, again, someone I know. There's something seriously wrong. Look at him with the way he looks, the constant hand gestures. There is something wrong there. And the sad truth is that we don't have a governor of California right now. We have a social media manager who's spending his time putting out dopey memes and social media attacks and posts on X. That seems to be his only focus, and saying these ridiculous things that are obviously untrue. Meanwhile, the state continues to be the worst performer in America on everything that matters. Obviously, crime and homelessness we've discussed, but we have the highest unemployment rate in the country, the highest poverty rate, the worst business climate, on and on. It's just a disaster. Highest cost for everything that matters, gas, electric, housing, rent, everything. A disaster. And this is what he's spending his time doing. I've said it before. I'm going to repeat it today. He should just resign. He should resign. If he's that uninterested in actually doing his job and only interested in his next job, which is what this is all about, running for president, then Gavin Newsom should resign. We have a perfectly good lieutenant governor, Eleni Kounoulakis, who's at least she cares about California. She's Democrat. I think a Republican would do better. Obviously, that's why I'm running. But we can't go on like this. It's embarrassing. It's really look at what he did over the weekend. Gavin Newsom now, he has his own version of Bridgegate, when he shut down the I-5 freeway, disrupting life for millions of Southern Californians, purely to troll President Trump over the Camp Pendleton Marines celebration. And he lied about it, totally lied, barefaced lying, Gavin Newsom, over the weekend.
So tell everyone what happened. We know the Marines had a celebration of their birthday, 250 years, and at which time there was some there was a rocket that almost went over the freeway that stopped things.
No. So it's absolute lie. So Camp Pendleton, the Marine base, is all along the Southern California coast. Huge, huge base. One of our greatest military installations that we're so proud of in the country. Been there for over 80 years. And if you drive from Orange County, from Southern California down to San Diego, the main way to get there is the I-5 freeway. And it goes right alongside Camp Pendleton. And for decades, people drive there perfectly safely. I've done it many times, up and down the coast there. They're literally using live fire. I've spoken to only people involved directly every single day. It's a training. It's a huge Marine base. They're training every single day with live munitions. This was a celebration, the 250th anniversary of the Marines, on Saturday. And they were doing exercises as part of the celebration, including using live fire munitions in the way that they always have. For days leading up to it, Gavin Newsom tried to use it as another opportunity for one of his pathetic social media stunts, and he started hyping it up about how there's going to be rockets fired over the freeway, it's not safe for people, whatever. And then they said that the freeway is going to have to be closed, and that they blamed the White House for it. So the White House and the Secret Service and so on. None of that was true. It was denied by every single part of the operation there, White House, Secret Service, the Marines, the Department of War. No one requested the closure of the freeway. Gavin Newsom ordered the freeway to be closed on Saturday morning. And it was closed for hours. And I've spoken to people who've been weddings disrupted, parents who couldn't go and see their kids play football, just mass disruption. And then he blamed it on Trump. And so the whole thing was staged. It really is Bridgegate. This is Gavin Newsom's Bridgegate. I mean, it's a sick political stunt. There's no limit, it seems, to how pathetic Gavin Newsom is being at the moment. And for one reason, and you asked earlier, why is he doing it? Because unfortunately, it seems to be working for him in the narrow focus he has right now, which is pandering to the Democratic base and the online people who are driving the conversation in the Democratic Party.
I mean, he's such a phony,
though.
You watch him on these podcasts, and he's cursing gratuitously. His hands don't match his words, which shows you that's an awkward nervousness thing that he does. The other thing is the front runner right now is Katie Porter. If you've seen a more embarrassing politician outside a member of the squad, I haven't met him yet. Maybe Crockett. But listen to some of what the front runner is like. Cut 49.
How would I need them in order to win, man?
Well, unless you think you're going to get 60% of the vote. You think you'll get 60%. Everybody who did not vote for Trump will vote for you. That's what you're saying.
In a general election? Yes. If it is me versus a Republican, I think that I will win the people who did not vote for Trump.
What if it's you versus another Democrat?
I don't intend that to be the case.
So how do you not intend that to be the case? Are you going to ask them not to run?
No, I'm saying I'm going to build the support. I have the support already in terms of name recognition. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to do the very best I can to make sure that we get through this primary in a really strong position. But let me be clear with you. I represented Orange County. I represented a purple area. Mm-hmm. I have stood on my own 2 feet and won Republican votes before. That's not something every candidate in this race can say. If you're from a deep blue area, if you're from L.A. or you're from Oakland, you don't have an experience.
But you just said you don't need those Trump voters.
Well, you asked me if I needed them to win.
So I wanted to have the build up because you always hear the blow up. I wanted people to hear the blow up. Number one, what an idiot. She doesn't control who's in. If she wins and comes in first, she doesn't control who's in second. The second could be you, right?
Well,
so if you're
right
in second, you'll get all the Republican votes. You have to be somewhat appealing to Republicans. And if you are going against a Democrat, you have to find a way to win over the 40% of Republicans. What is wrong with those questions?
Of course. I mean, it's ridiculous. But this is the attitude, Brian. I mean, this is now over a week, nearly 2 weeks since this has been out there on Katie Porter. And the reason it's so devastating is that it's not just her, actually. The attitude you heard there is the attitude of California Democrats generally. This arrogance, the entitlement. They've had 15 years of one-party rule. They think it's going to go on forever. They assume that there's going to be no check or accountability for their massive failures, and they're just going to go on and on getting reelected. And that's not going to happen this time, because right now I am the other candidate. I mean, in all the polls, I'm in the top two with her. And look, she might go down now. Who knows? It's still a bit early. But I'll be in the top two. I'll be the champion for change we need. And here's another number. People talk about the Republican percentage vote in California. Fine, it's actually higher than people think. For the last 10 years or so, 20 years actually, it's been pretty stable at around just under 42%. So it's not 50, but it's not 20 either. That gap is bridgeable. And here's another number, very important, 65%. That's the latest Public Policy Institute of California poll. They do it all the time, asking, is the state going in the right direction or the wrong direction? 65% wrong direction. That is a big number for change. And actually, that's been steady over 60% or over for the last 2 years. People are sick of this in California. I really feel strongly. People need to understand I've got a very, very good shot next year. I'm not saying it's easy. Of course not. It's going to be difficult. But I'm fighting like no one's fought for this state for a long time. And I'm very confident we can pull it off.
Well, I want you to hear. So the second half, if this is the front runner, there is absolutely nobody of worth in this field. The other guy is a joke, is Xavier Becerra. I mean, what a terrible HHS secretary. So they want to make him governor? Are you kidding? Cut 50.
So you don't
I
think
feel like this is unnecessarily argumentative. What is your question?
Do you think you need any of those 40% of California voters to win? And you're saying, no, you don't.
No, I'm saying I'm going to try to win every vote I can. And what I'm saying to you is that.
Well, to those voters. Okay, so you.
I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it. Okay. Thank you.
You're not going to do the interview with us?
Nope, not like this. I'm not. Not with 7 follow-ups to every single question you ask.
Every other candidate has answered
I don't care. I don't care. I want to have a pleasant, positive conversation in which you ask me about every issue on this list. And if every question you're going to make up a follow-up question, then we're never going to get there.
Ms.
And we're just going to circle around.
I mean, where do you start? You're a communications expert even before you started running for office. What would you say if that was your client?
You'd say, look, she's just got to completely, go out there and say, this is a disaster for me and I messed it up and I'm really sorry and I'm going to do better. She hasn't done that. She's been out kind of apologizing, not really, because the arrogance is there, all of them. And so I don't think she comes back from this, honestly. And we are hearing very strongly that the Democrat machine in California, which has been pulling the strings for all these years, very powerful machine, the unions, of course, and Nancy Pelosi still runs that machine. They are trying to draft into the race Alex Padilla, the current U.S. senator. He's the one, if you remember, who made a fool of himself by barging into Kristi Noem's press conference and creating that. Another one who just obsessed with these stunts. He was appointed to the Senate, by the way, by Gavin Newsom when Kamala Harris ran for vice president, became vice president. And then that's how we got there. He's just a crony of Newsom's, complete mediocrity, no leadership in a new direction, which is what we need in California. We've got to do better. We're the biggest state in America. We're the fourth biggest economy in the world. We cannot go on like this with these pathetic excuses for leadership when actually we need to go in a new direction to deal with the problems here. It's just outrageous.
Well, keep running hard, Steve. You definitely have an open field. There's not a lot of talent in front of you. You just got to go uphill because you're a Republican in a Democratic state. Steve Hilton, continued success.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be with you.
All right, back in a moment with your calls. I know it's been a busy weekend, a lot on your mind. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hundreds of people in Portland sent a message to ICE to leave their city by riding their bikes naked through the rain. And you're not going to believe this. It didn't work.
So that was, did you watch the weekend update?
Yes, I watched it. There wasn't much, but we got to.
Did you see the cold open on SNL?
I watched some of it. It was so bad, I turned it off.
Hideous. I mean, you would think maybe a high school play. If you came over to high school, you go, well, nice try. At least they're trying to, do something live on stage. It was so unrehearsed, so not funny, not more than anything political that you could say, wow, that reminds me of something in the headlines. I mean, that's the way they've been grabbing people, trying to do something that creates news.
Mm-hmm. Now, they tried to highlight, it was Sabrina Carpenter was the host, and then they basically changed the words to the popular Taylor Swift song. I turned it off halfway. I'm like, this. Well, I was also thought, we're not using this for our show at all this morning. It's not helpful.
You know, they should be using Amy Poehler or somebody. Lorne Michaels must be just shot because he's done it for 50 years. Obviously, he's not hands-on. He used to know more than anything else what was funny, even cutting edge. But now, how could he ever sign off on these acts? One was stupider than the next.
But I am curious, though, were they trying, since it wasn't a political cold open, to see how that's going to rate as opposed to always going political?
But you got
to
make it funny, well, right? Fair. Or make it recognizable. Do something. I mean, it was just a bad skit.
But between Sabrina Carpenter in it and singing a Taylor Swift song, maybe that'll be enough.
I think America has higher standards. That's why they're going to come November 1st to History, Liberty, and Laughs in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. And, of course, the whole country is looking at our mayor's race. We'll get to that. Also, a bombshell poll is now out. So if you put AARP, put together this poll, the Gotham Polling Company, and said if you want Cuomo against Mondami, it would be within the margin of error, 44%. For Mondami, 40% for Cuomo. That's if Curtis Sliwa quit the race. Sliwa now has 19.4% of the vote, Cuomo 28, and 43% for Mondami, which is pathetic considering that Eric Adams won with 70% of the vote. So there's a lot going on because people are really concerned, like me, that if a socialist wins in New York City, they're going to start popping up all over the place. And knowing that Democrats have the biggest crowds with AOC and Bernie Sanders, is the other party, instead of being center left, way left? Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're going to go to San Francisco. The difference is I think they want us in San Francisco. San Francisco was truly one of the great cities of the world. And then 15 years ago, it went wrong. It went woke.
Next stop, San Fran. Trump has decided after the success in Memphis and D.C. and minor success in Chicago and Portland, thanks to the courts, it hasn't been full-blown yet, he'll bring his law enforcement team to San Fran. Will it finally clean up that city? Will they open up their arms or fold them and cross them? We're going to look at how all these major cities seem to be cooking the books on crime stats to make it seem like it's going down.
Number two.
He has a very narrow path to winning this race because what New Yorkers saw is the fact that it's more of the same with Andrew Cuomo. It's more of the same with the affordability crisis. It's more of the same with the style of politics.
Yeah, I will say one thing. Mondami would not be more of the same. Mayor Mondami, should we get used to saying that? I hope not, but Cuomo and Sliwa have just 2 weeks to massively change things. If they both stay in the race, they will both lose. New Jersey and Virginia elections also tighten in blue states.
Number one.
I heard the president asked you what the chances were for success.
Yes.
And you said?
100%. And he said, why do you feel so confident?
Yeah.
And I said, well, we can't afford to fail.
Gaza and Ukraine, the path to peace, the stakes and the absolute latest in both war zones. I'll give you my take on their path to peace. Number one, when it comes to Gaza, it's going to be tenuous every single day. But I love the fact that after two IDF soldiers were killed, and what a tragedy just for standing on the line that they were given, the yellow line, they were killed by two Hamas members. Then they just came back and they wiped out 14. And they, I hope, blew up the tunnels in which they popped out of. Both sides went right back to the ceasefire. So that means we don't want to blow it. They don't want to blow it. Hamas said, we have nothing to do with the Rafah section. We lost touch with them. I don't believe that. Either do you. On the Ukraine side, it's very simple. The president should ask the Senate to pass that sanctions bill. They got 85 votes. Put it on his desk. And then he should say, Tomahawks, I'm going to deliver it to Zelensky, but don't use him until I tell you. Go to Hungary and see if Vladimir Putin really wants to deal. And if he doesn't, like he did in Alaska, if he wants to give us his Russian history speech, you say, okay, I got to run. You go back, you sign that, it's a massive sanctions, and then you let them use the Tomahawks. Jeffrey Lacks joins us now, Cooney Professor of Law, not talking about those two conflicts, but talking about a huge conflict, and that is, in my view, the Mayor Mondami in New York. Jeff, should we get used to saying that? Jeff is a Cooney Professor of Law. Should we get used
God
to saying
forbid,
it?
God forbid, Brian.
Is it going to happen?
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm very encouraged by the poll you just mentioned, which says 44 to 40 in favor of Mondani in a two-way race. look at the margin of people, though. Look at the number of votes that are still out there. I find that very interesting. If you look back to the last time Sliwa ran, he only got 27% of the vote against against Eric Adams, but he's only getting 12 now. So where are those 15% of Republicans? They're sitting it out because they don't like that he's running. So I think there's actually a lot of vote out there for Cuomo, who you and I have been discussing for a long time. Neither one of us thinks he's exactly the most qualified and best guy for this job. But we all now are in DEFCON 1, I think, and trying to avoid a disaster that Mamdani would no doubt be. So that is encouraging to me.
Yeah, right, so here's the story. He's got so many forces working for him, including left-wing academics, including the one place you work at. They say that there's a few professors who are using their college email, the email, to try to recruit voters and raise money for Mamdani. Can you expand on that?
Violates New York City law, violates New York State law, violates COLEG, which is the Commission on Ethics and Lobbying in Government. These people are not just union delegates or union members. There was an article in the Post the other day by Rich Calder, which exposed this story. They're union leaders, a chapter chair and a chapter vice chair. These are union heads, leaders at campuses who are sending out emails using government taxpayer email systems to promote Mamdani, which is illegal. They should be investigated by the org, by COLEG, this commission. They should be at least fined, and this actually could be a misdemeanor, and they could serve prison time for doing this. But this is not in the least bit surprising. Even a Democratic councilman came out the other day and said, I think it was Robert Holden, came out the other day and said, he's not surprised by this. This is a Democrat. He said the party's become so radicalized, and the unions specifically are so radicalized, that he saw this happening and it has to change. And he actually used the word clean house, that the Democrats need to clean house with these union representatives.
Oh, by the way, most unions are against illegal immigrants because they're taking a lot of their jobs and driving the price of wages down. That's why so many went to Trump. So as you pick them up and you straighten out these businesses and try to enforce E-Verify, it actually helps the American worker. So that's something to think about when it comes to unions. But when it comes to the teachers union, they're off the charts bad. If you want to get an idea of why New Yorkers are voting for Mamdani, let's take a listen. Cut 23.
Do you know who you're voting for?
I'm going to vote for Mamdani.
Why?
Because Cuomo is a fascist. Mamdani, honestly, I don't know if he's got good ideas. I don't think a lot of ideas are going to work, but he's got optimism.
It's everything they're not. And he has a lot of good talking points. And we don't need the same status quo thing.
So he's got talking points. His ideas aren't going to work, but I'm going to vote for him. I mean, how scary is that?
Yeah, and somebody taught him, I really wonder who it was, to smile all the time. Never stop smiling. You notice he's always smiling. And because he wants to come off as this likable, casual guy you can talk to. And, you know, the master of this of all time was Obama. His policies were horrible, but he was the kind of guy you wanted to hang out with. I know a lot of Republicans that said that to me even, that he's the kind of president. So Mamdani is trying to get away with avoiding his policies, because you see, he's actually not talking about his policies. He's running away right now from his policies. He's trying to make himself seem like the likable candidate and avoid. You saw with Martha McCallum, he avoided answering all of her questions, which was so on point. And he's trying to run away from that.
Also, Rosanna Scotto, too, on Channel 5. He doesn't have any answers. Won't apologize to cops. Then all of a sudden, the next day, he apologizes to cops.
Right.
So he says, I'm not really going to get rid of the gifted program. Just in kindergarten, I'm getting rid of it. Well, you know that's not true. And you'd also know the charter schools he's going to take aim at, because he sold his soul to the teachers unions, and he probably believes it. It's why Democratic leadership won't endorse him. Listen to this. Schumer, Gillibrand, Keith Jeffries, they don't want to answer. You know, to Swazi's credit, Laura Gillins, these are New York politicians. They both said, we're out. So show some guts and be out. But listen to Jeffries again yesterday, cut 24.
Well, as I've indicated, I expect to have a conversation with him at some point this week in advance of early voting, which begins next weekend in New York City. And we'll certainly have more to say about the mayor's race and about our Democratic nominee prior to early voting beginning.
So he's not saying, hey, Cuomo's my friend. He's still having conversations. They had good conversations a month ago. And they're having conversations last week. And they're going to have another conversation this week. Jeff, what's the big deal? Just support the guy. What is the fallout?
Yeah, well, Kathy Hochul endorsed him. And I think that's going to come back to haunt her, whether he wins or not. Why are they scared? Why is Schumer scared? Schumer is a disgrace. Schumer is afraid of his own shadow. He's obviously afraid of AOC primarying him, which she's going to do anyway. His career is done. Schumer is not winning another Senate race. So that's why he's not doing it. He wants to see all he is. Schumer has always been about Schumer. It's always ever been about winning races, all he cares about. Hochul, I think, made a huge miscalculation because Mamdani is going to do things that directly conflict with the interests of New York State. And Andrew Cuomo, for all his faults, he is fully aware of that. He knows that better than he bumped heads plenty of times with Bill de Blasio. And usually between de Blasio and Cuomo, Cuomo was the much more level-headed person, which is about the nicest thing I could say about him. And I think Hochul's putting herself in a really strange position because she's, for example, Israel. She's come out very strongly in support of Israel. And now she's going to have a mayor who not only said he's going to get rid of Mayor Adams' executive order that does not allow BDS in New York City, he said he wants to put in place an executive order to support boycotting Israel. The opposite.
Yeah.
So what's she going to say about that?
So it's absolutely. So in terms of what Democrats are fearing, Sarah Isger, who's become a critic of Trump, who used to work for Trump, said this. Cut 25.
They are terrified that this guy is going to be an anchor on the party heading into the midterms. The second he gets into office, he moves to the far left, and that he is the poster child for Republicans, that the midterms don't become a referendum on Trump, that they become a referendum on the mayor of New York, a Democratic socialist who then becomes the face of the Democratic Party, the message of the Democratic Party, because they haven't had anyone else except Joe Biden.
Right. And on top of that, the other person that they could have is AOC, also a socialist leftist, or Crockett, also a socialist leftist incompetent, who just is a flamethrower. So that'll be the face of the party. I don't know who else. You know, Governor Beshear, I don't know. Does he look like the face of the party? They'd love it, but he doesn't stand up and do anything. Governor Shapiro has a speech once in a while, you know. Wes Moore, I don't know. These other ones get the heat, get the interest.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we know yet who it could very well be AOC. I have no idea who right now. They don't really have a face of the party. But historically, if you look at the mayors of New York, there's a long and rich history of mayors not necessarily doing very well for many decades, but running for president. Obviously, yeah. We know de Blasio
Giuliani
failed miserably in his bid. Giuliani was doing well for a while back in the Hillary Clinton
that Florida
years
strategy.
He was running for president.
All right, so on education, this is deadline day for colleges to sign on to President Trump's preferential funding deal. The deadline is today. It's going to be a contact for higher education to agree to suppress campus criticism of conservatives in their group. Not suppress. I think it's open a line of credit. This is a biased reporting of conservatives and abandon DEI efforts in exchange for preferential treatment in federal funding. People that are against it, USC, Penn, Brown, MIT, have rejected the proposal. So we'll see where this goes because there's no outside guys like you, Jeff, in these cities. There's almost no conservative presence among the faculty and anti-Israel, anti-Semitism raging. The president's trying to tackle all this at once. What percentage of universities will be compliant on this, do you think, off the top of your head? And how many in New York?
Boy, that's a tough question. But I think what the clip you played from Katie Porter a few minutes ago is instructive when she was asked, do you need the 40%, even in California, of Republicans, of Trump voters? And I think universities are at least starting to realize that a huge percentage, it may not be the majority, but it might be 30, 40%, even in New York City, are leaning conservative. And I can tell you that in the years that I've been doing this, Brian, more and more people are being comfortable for the first time coming forward and saying,
really?
These people are, yeah.
So, Jeff, how many people at CUNY, for example, are conservative? How many professors, teachers?
Yeah, I will have to tell you, this is something that shocks me because I would have agreed with the public polling we've seen over the years that like 10% is conservative. I don't think that's true. I think it's probably closer to what New York City's actual vote is in general elections. I think it's closer to 35-40%.
Good. I love to see it with the curriculum and in the schools, because City College is basically a you with a bulwark trying to keep some balance there. Jeff, thanks so much. Appreciate it. So thanks for telling us. And of course, the original story is CUNY professors using their email on campus to raise money and raise awareness for Zohran Mamdani against the law. Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
President Trump announced that another alleged drug smuggling boat from Venezuela has been blown out of the water without warning. And you may not think that's a big deal right now, but one day soon, you'll look at yourself in the mirror and realize you're out of cocaine.
It's pretty funny. Yeah, that was pretty funny, right?
It was a good one.
So Senator Kelly said over the weekend, well, that's a pathway for cocaine where we're blowing people up to the UK or to Europe. I never heard that. So Venezuela, he knows the pathway to cocaine. So the cocaine from Venezuela goes to the Caribbean, Puerto Rico, en route to Europe. So Senator Kelly, once again, you might not like it, and Rand Paul and company, and there might be some other people say, well, I don't, you know, we're not reading the Miranda rights. But when you have a boat that hits all these different characteristics that's heading in that direction, and you desperately want to stop the drug trade from blitzing and killing people in America, you take your shot. And I love the pressure that's brought. Now, when it comes to regime change, the other thing they're confused about with Venezuela is we're not looking to oust Maduro. Let the people oust Maduro. They did already. 70% went to the other leader who's in exile right now, who just got the Nobel Peace Prize. She would take over. Now, we're not placing her there. The Venezuelan people are placing her there. But since she doesn't have any guns or an army, she's never going to take power. Maduro's always going to be a nest. It's going to be a nest for Iran, Russia, and China, and Cuba. Why would we continue to tolerate this in our area? So instead of going in there and invading, by the way, they got like 125,000 troops, none of which even had uniforms to try to intimidate us back. So we are looking at Venezuela as a real problem in our hemisphere. We looked at Panama as a real problem in our hemisphere. We're looking at Colombia, a cocaine mecca, with this leader as a problem in our hemisphere. And we have a president not only trying to win trade wars and real wars for our allies, but also trying to clean up our hemisphere, exactly what he was doing. And I just think it's almost hysterically stupid that Governor Newsom and Governor Pritzker have one theme. The president's losing it. Losing it. What person losing it is literally doing 35 things at one time? I could name 35 different operations that he's running, big and small. And he's on top of all of it, calling people at 3 in the morning, 7 in the morning. Was Joe Biden doing that? Robert Mueller, they say, is losing it, sadly. Right? Do you think he was doing that? Losing it. I mean, out of everything you want to say about Trump, I would not say that would fit the description of what we've been seeing at all. Coming up next, Miranda Devine's going to be with us. She's doing a special on cocaine at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Not with Trump, of course, not drugs. You know who's there. This is about the cocaine in the Biden administration. She does an investigation. She works for the New York Post. She's got her own podcast. She's going to be with us shortly, and we'll talk about everything, including Jack Smith. Now he's under the spotlight. I'll tell you why. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
When I learned that the cocaine was destroyed, the evidence in this crime was destroyed in 11 days. Something wasn't right. It just wasn't right. I didn't understand why they would do that.
I mean, in Washington, no investigations open and close within 11 days. That's virtually unheard of.
So what happened? That was Frank leverage on the cocaine found at the White House. Frank's a secret former Secret Service officer. All of a sudden, you hear there's cocaine at the White House, and then the whole thing's buried. No big deal. We know it's a big deal, but Donald Trump's not in the presidency. Joe Biden was barely there. Miranda Devine, New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor, host of Pod Force One, and now she's hosting the special Cocaine at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, available right now on Fox Nation. So, Miranda, what attracted you to this story?
Well, hi, Brian. Look, obviously, it's because the Hunter Biden laptop I'd been covering for so long, and we'd been reporting that Hunter Biden at the time had been pretty much living off and on at the White House with his wife and his child in the residence. And then suddenly this cocaine is found, and he's the most famous person in the White House who at least previously had a big cocaine problem. And it was all very strange. You know, there was a little baggie with cocaine found in the area near the Situation Room in the West Wing, where there are these little cubby holes to put your cell phones. And the door was unlocked. And we were told initially that it was found elsewhere in the West Wing. And then we're told, oh, no, it was found oddly in this little, at the very edge of this little cubbyhole. And then they closed the investigation within 11 days. They said there were no fingerprints, there was no DNA evidence, none of it, as Donald Trump said at the time, passed the sniff test.
Right. Here's Tim Burchett, also on the special. Cut 47.
I could read the agents' faces. They knew they were going to get blistered by members of Congress. To me, it just reeked of a setup, and they knew it, and we knew it. I mean, it was comical almost that they were forced to say all this to us.
Say what?
Well, tell them that there was nothing, no evidence, that it was impossible to find out who it was. I mean, at one point, the White House even blamed construction workers who had been in the White House at the time. It was a desperate scramble to avoid culpability. And, I don't know if it was Hunter. It could have been someone else. But Susan Crabtree did some good reporting from her sources in the Secret Service, many of whom were not happy about the way this was handled, and found that actually they did find enough DNA to run a check through the criminal database, and that there was a partial match to someone in the White House. So someone working at the West Wing anyway, working or there.
What do you mean? So who was it? Who
they? We don't know. I mean, it could be.
But how did you know there was a match? Who told you there was a match?
No, Susan Crabtree, who's a reporter for Real Clear Politics, reported this from her sources in the Secret Service. She has very good sources. And look, this has been terrible for the Secret Service. And of course, after that, we had the Butler rally when they did not protect Donald Trump adequately. And so there have been problems with the Secret Service. And I would say they stem from the fact that Joe Biden politicized it from the get-go. He put in one of his favorites to head it, who had been on his personal detail when he was vice president. And then they covered up this dramatic story. And, you know, it is unheard of, as any law enforcement people will tell you, to destroy the evidence within a couple of weeks of this crime being discovered. And it is a crime in DC to have this amount of cocaine. So why they destroyed it? And apparently the Secret Service personnel that were instructed to destroy it didn't want to do that. So there is mystery upon mystery, which is why Kash Patel and the FBI have decided to reopen this case. And they should have enough evidence from the investigation that hasn't been destroyed to put two and two together and at least be transparent with the American public, because we all knew it was a cover-up. And if it wasn't Hunter, I think this was incredibly unfair to him, because as the most famous former crackhead in the White House, obviously all fingers pointed to him. He has since claimed it wasn't him and how preposterous that he would leave it in that cubbyhole. But that's a pretty weird denial, because The evidence is that it was actually found elsewhere and put in the cubbyhole. That part of the transcript that's been retained from FOI, from the Secret Service investigation, that was redacted. So the FBI and Kash Patel ought to have access to that and know where exactly in the White House was that cocaine baggie first found. And, you know, the other thing was that Karine Jean-Pierre, who was the White House press spokesman at the time, just raised more suspicions with her abject denials that, oh, no, the first family wasn't even there. Well, yes, they were there when the baggie was found. And she said, oh, they were gone all of, you know, July 2nd or the Friday, whatever it was. And in fact, they were there until 6 p.m. So it was all very dishonest. And that was why it became a bigger story than it might have.
It's amazing that it went away. It's just amazing that, and there wasn't a lot of curiosity. Just the same thing. There's not a lot of curiosity about his diminished mental ability. Just lastly, just one more cut from your special. As Tim Burchett, the congressman from Tennessee, said, this sounds like a setup, Cut 48.
That cocaine had a pair of legs. Originally, it was told to be in one area, and then many sources had said that. And then, in fact, no, it was found in another area, the one area where there weren't any cameras. They had to move the cocaine and get it somewhere in a hurry.
So obviously they looked into it. They knew it was a problem with it, but they just closed the investigation. And now where does it stand?
Well, it stands with the FBI. They're doing an investigation. I can't imagine that it should take them very long. Maybe they're interviewing people who were at the White House at the time. They could be doing that. They really ought to, but we were told by the Secret Service when they wrapped up in record time their initial investigation that, oh, no, there were just too many people in that area to investigate, which is ridiculous. I mean, the White House would have to be the most secure location on the planet.
So I want to bring you to KJP's book that's coming out. I don't want to sell her books, but I'm just fascinated by her take. She basically has left the Democratic Party because they left Joe Biden. She said that she talks about this being surreal. Biden seemed to be totally at peace after he made his decision. But I was stunned. My feelings a blur. I was angry and sad. I was enraged and heartbroken. This man had given 50 years of his life to serving the American people. And in the end, he's been treated so poorly by the members of his own party. It was horrible. The Democratic Party defined my life, my career. Everything I've done to make people's lives better had been connected to it. The party was a vehicle that allowed me to have a front seat on history, working first on Obama's presidential campaign, but also making history, as usual, as a black woman, openly queer person to ever be at the White House press secretary. Your thoughts about the outrage she feels that Joe Biden couldn't finish out his doddering term where he basically was a blank slate for 4 years.
I mean, that is so typical of her. She was the most self-engrossed person, I think, ever to have stood on a podium. And she was terrible at her job.
Horrible.
Just, you know, you see Carolyn Leavitt now and how she commands that room, how calm she is, how full of information she is. What a contrast to Karine Jean-Pierre. And Donald Trump jokes all the time about pretty low bar, he said, for him and Caroline, considering their predecessors. But I guess she has to be loyal to Joe Biden because there's no way she would ever have had a job like that if it weren't for the fact that Joe Biden cared about nothing else but identity politics. So she owes him big time.
Miranda, they tried to get her out. Didn't they try to set her up with Angie's List? Anything to get her out. She was terrible at her job and she wouldn't do it. And then we know, too, that Joe Biden couldn't have meetings because he was incapable. She hid that. And she thinks that we don't know it yet. She doesn't understand the auto pen in the story is real, that Jake Tapper, of all people, wrote a book that he wasn't basically there. We know that she is not only vacuous as an individual, but she had no information from the chief executive, which is why she wasted everyone's time in the press room every single day. And now she says the mistake was not standing by Joe Biden. Did you see Joe Biden? I feel terrible because he's got cancer, but he had cancer then too, by the way. I don't know if she knew it. And now after he looks like a shell of himself, and he was a shell of himself last time we saw him.
Well, I mean, he was a shell of himself throughout his presidency. We have to be honest about that.
Yep.
You know, back in 2020, when he was campaigning in New Hampshire and Iowa in January, he was a shell. So it was just outrageous that the Democratic Party foisted someone with so little cognitive ability on the American people, and they got away with it for almost 4 years. And then they tried to foist his understudy on us, Kamala Harris, who's, I mean, just as cognitively challenged, it seems, from her bizarre public utterances and her terrible book launch. I think, look, Karine Jean-Pierre, unlike Carolyn Leavitt, who sits with President Trump through all his meetings, she is very smart, but she also has the ear of the president. She asks him questions, he respects her, and she's there. She sees things unfold, and she is very good at delivering a message. So she goes out to the press corps, and she gives them real information that they can use in real stories. Yeah. They are inundated with information. And yet, for the 4 years of Joe Biden, they never complained, really. They all stuck up for him. You know, I went to one of those White House Press Association dinners, and they were all sucking up to Joe Biden up on the stage. It was quite shameful. And I mean, if the Fourth Estate cares about freedom of speech, et cetera, you know, like they do now, they're walking out of the Pentagon and so on. Where were they during the Biden years when they were just fed complete and utter garbage, yep, horse manure and nothing?
And the two people who have come out should be disqualified immediately, Kamala Harris and KJP, because they knew about it. They knew how cognitively challenged he was, how much jeopardy our country was in with two hot wars at the time and China growing more aggressive by the day. And all they did try to do was cover up for him. And to this day, they still don't admit it. I mean, that's why this is, I hope at one stop that she gets legitimately grilled, because she does stay in the one excerpt I read in Newsweek that she went to The View and everyone told her what a great job she was doing.
Isn't that incredible? I think that's part of her problem, is she has quite a fragile ego. And so she surrounds herself with people who, like her sister and her brother-in-law, who pump her up, who tell her how wonderful she is. And I mean, her book is incredible. There are so many insights into her, I guess, inadvertently into who she is. There's one where she's talking about how she was upset because Dougie, her husband, was dispatched by her staff to her hotel in Philadelphia so they could have a special birthday evening. And he'd been busy traveling around the country stumping for her, and he hadn't organized a special night. And she was so disappointed. And then he gave her a present that she said was repurposed from a wedding anniversary, yes, present with the wrong date on the back. So she flounces off to take a long bath. And then she calls for a towel, but Doug is listening. He's in the other room and he's watching the baseball and he doesn't hear her. So she texts him, or she calls him, and she's very angry with him. And he says, "What? What's the problem?" And so she said they got into it and had a big fight. She said, like every couple does, "No, I don't call for my husband to bring me a towel. He's not my servant." It's insane. Crazy. I mean, she's like a princess.
But let me tell you something. This guy dropped the ball. I'm also looking at him. He couldn't care less. She's upset. Doesn't have a birthday present. He watches again. I mean, I'm looking at him and saying, that's terrible. And I'm looking at her. How would you ever in a million years put that in a book? As if,
no.
Why would you? I mean, if that was a story, I would deny it, even if it was true.
100%.
So it's just so clueless. It's crazy. Clueless. And then she keeps telling people that it was the closest election in a century. We know it's not true. I mean, it's numbers. It's not opinion. It's a numbers game.
I mean, she lost every single metric possible. She lost, obviously, the Electoral College. She lost the popular vote. She lost every swing state. And Donald Trump won practically every county. It was a comprehensive victory for her to turn around at every stop on her book tour and tell these gullible audiences who seem to love her. They're called the K-Hive, these people, and they're mostly women, and they just think she's wonderful. And I think it's because they've been all their lives from school, brainwashed into thinking there's going to be a female president and has to be a Democrat because only the Democrats aren't sexist. And it's going to happen in my lifetime. And if it doesn't happen, I'm not validated as a woman. And the only reason that a woman doesn't win, like Hillary and Kamala, is because of sexism in the country. It's ridiculous. But that's, I guess, the way they feel.
Miranda, we have so much in common. We could talk for 3 hours. But in the meantime, I appreciate the minutes you gave me. Watch the full special on Fox Nation America's favorite streaming service. It's called Cocaine at 1600. And always check out Pod Force One. Force. That is Miranda's podcast and what reader columns. Miranda, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Brian. Right. And the special, the cocaine special, is unbelievable, mind blowing.
Yeah, absolutely. And whatever you do, do not buy any of the books we talked about. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. And just a quick note, coming up on five, it comes up in a really quick in 2 weeks now, November 1st. I'll be in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, right in the middle there. The tickets are selling quick. We have more VIPs on this event than any other that we've had. We're also in Fort Myers on February 14th. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Fort Myers is selling incredibly well. But let me say, just go to BrianKilmeade.com. We're going to stream on Fox Nation, too, but you probably want to see it in person if you're in the local area. It's History, Liberty, and Laughs. I bring my 6 history books to life along with the 2 sports books, and we also have a lot of fun. We literally bring it to life. It's a show like you're not going to ever expect before. So I hope to see everybody there in Fort Myers in February and in November 1st in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. So we'll make sure of that. A quick note, the President of the United States is going to meet with the Australian Prime Minister today. You never know what's going to be happening. I think it's going to be in about 15 minutes. He's going to be pulling up to the White House. Look, we have issues with them. Number one, we're late giving them nuclear submarines. That's a deal that Joe Biden cut without telling France. So they dropped the French deal and they went with us. We haven't delivered them. What's going on, guys? But for the rest, they got some dicey relationships. They're not buying our agricultural products. They have been way too nice to China. They've been flooded with Chinese immigrants there, so the influence has been spreading. They got the same issue as us. When they come to town, China tries to take over. So we have to get them, let them know that China's not our friend, even though they're their neighbors. So we'll see what happens. All right, keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country and the world, this is Brian Kilmeade Show. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action now. President of the United States about to greet the Prime Minister of Australia. They'll have some substantive things to talk about. And Australia's got to be complaining, too. We have not gotten the nuclear submarines we promised, or Joe Biden promised. We're trying to figure that out. Meanwhile, Congressman Andy Barr is with us in studio. He's with the Financial Services Subcommittee on Financial Institutions, Foreign Affairs. We'll talk to him about where he'd really want to be, and that's in Washington, because we're in a shutdown right now. We're in day 20, believe it or not. And before we get to the congressman from Kentucky, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're going to go to San Francisco. The difference is I think they want us in San Francisco. San Francisco was truly one of the great cities of the world. And then 15 years ago, it went wrong.
Yeah,
it went woke.
Next stop, San Francisco. Trump has decided after the success in Memphis and D.C., Chicago and Portland to a degree, he'll bring his law enforcement team to San Fran. The problem is they got a governor there that's not going to be welcoming. He'll put a lot of pressure on them, but they got to make sure that actually they're getting the type of stats in these major cities that shows crimes going down. It turns out they might be cooking the books.
Number two.
He has a very narrow path to winning this race, because what New Yorkers saw is the fact that it's more of the same with Andrew Cuomo. It's more of the same with the affordability crisis. It's more of the same with the style of politics.
But a new poll shows that without Curtis Lee in the race, Cuomo would be within the margin of error. Should we get used to saying Mayor Mamdani? We'll talk about that in the Virginia races, as well as New Jersey. Everything is tightening up.
Number one.
I heard the president ask you what the chances were for success.
Yes.
And you said?
100%. And he said, why do you feel so confident?
Yeah.
And I said, well, we can't afford to fail.
Gaza and Ukraine, their path to peace, the stakes, and the absolute latest in both war zones. We'll go over that now with the congressman from Kentucky. Congressman, welcome.
Hey, Brian. Good to be with you.
How frustrating is it for you not to be in Washington?
Well, it's frustrating for all Americans. It's frustrating for me, but I really feel for the TSA agents, the air traffic controllers, the essential federal workers. You know, what you do find out in government shutdowns that there's quite a bit of non-essential government activity. But for those essential workers, this is totally unnecessary, uncalled for. And the TSA agents in my hometown, when I walked through security this right. morning, they know that I did my job and House Republicans did our job. We voted to fund the government over 20 days ago. And we still are dealing with these antics from the far left.
And you thought the No Kings rally would get it out of their system? Any signs that Democrats are looking to break and go back to work?
I don't think so. I think this has kind of evolved into their fighting for defending their broken Obamacare legislation. The fact that Democrats are now admitting that they shut down the government over ACA subsidies is proof that and an acknowledgement of the failure of their signature healthcare legislation, Obamacare.
Because the supplements put in there, the tax breaks and the money was put there during the pandemic. Whether you like it or not, that's what Joe Biden did, but never he meant to be permanent. I'm quoting Senator Fetterman on that.
And Fetterman's right. That they actually created these, designed these supplemental ACA subsidies to expire. They built in the expiration into the fix. And the reason why they had to fix it is because the Affordable Care Act, as it turns out, was unaffordable. If you look at premium escalation in purely private commercial insurance and compare it to premium inflation under the ACA exchanges, it's like 60% more under the exchanges. The architecture of the ACA was completely inadequate, and it has produced a totally unaffordable healthcare system. The only way that Democrats can fix that is to try to mask the true cost of Obamacare with these
taxpayer
subsidies.
They want to blame private insurance. And you heard Ro Khanna on Sunday tell Shannon Bream, well, we want to get rid of private insurance altogether. They're the problems. That's a lot of jobs, and that's the free market. I'm not saying that we can't examine where they're getting their premiums from. And let's see if they are gouging the American people. But if that's cheaper than Obamacare, I think they should look in the mirror.
They really should. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, there are problems in the private commercial health insurance marketplace, but it's because it's a dysfunctional market, because Obamacare and the government payers have crowded out private health insurance. And so it's a much smaller piece of the overall healthcare ecosystem. And when you have a smaller, yeah. less competitive private marketplace, you're going to get higher costs.
So for you personally, Mitch McConnell is clearly going to retire. Sadly, he fell down the other day just walking. So your thoughts about replacing him?
So look, I mean, it's been an honor of my lifetime to represent the Central Kentucky District in Congress these last 13 years. I think I could do that statewide with greater impact and reach. And let's face it, Kentucky has punched above its weight. Kentucky's a relatively small state, and yet we're losing influence in the United States Senate. I can hit the ground running. I have existing relationships in Washington. I know the job, and I can do the job well. And as the chairman of President Trump's campaign in 2024 in Kentucky, he knows that I've been fighting with him, alongside of him, as an effective advocate for the president's agenda.
Not this year, next year.
2026. And I can be a strong America first voice for the president
so
and
Kentucky. Have you formally entered into this?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We're off and running. This will be my last term in the U.S. House, and I will be and I am a candidate for U.S. Senate in the Republican primary. It looks like the Democratic nominee in this U.S. Senate race may very well be my former opponent, Amy McGrath, who raised, by the way, after I defeated her in 2018, held a purple district in Kentucky against Amy McGrath, and $20 million that came in against me from Nancy Pelosi. She then ran against McConnell, raised almost $100 million in 2020. She's now running for a third time. I've beat her once. I can beat her again.
So Governor Beshear, they always point out to a Democrat who does well in a red state. What is Governor Beshear's record?
His record is taking credit for the Republican legislature's accomplishments. That's effectively his record. Look, Governor Beshear.
Famously, he's got a family of Republicans. He's the only Democrat in there. And people like to say on the outside that he's a moderate. But every time I say that, let's say that people, they say so-called moderate, I get blitzed by people in Kentucky and say, he is not a moderate. Don't be fooled.
That's right. I mean, I think he was the architect of some of the most draconian shutdowns we saw during COVID, where he actually sent law enforcement into church parking lots to get the license plates of churchgoers' cars to punish them for actually going to church and worship. He totally mismanaged the unemployment insurance issue during then. And then when he was in his, you know, attempt to become Kamala Harris's running mate, he really exposed himself for the liberal that he actually is.
So I want to bring it over to Ukraine because the president's going to be going there in a couple of weeks to Hungary to talk to Vladimir Putin. I really believe the president should do two things. Deliver the tomahawks to Ukraine and say, Zelensky, don't touch him unless I tell you you can. And they should get that legislation from the Senate. 85 signatures at minimum. Put it on my desk, guys. I'm not going to sign it until I get back. And if he tries to pull Vladimir Putin, what he did in Alaska, and give us a speech on the history of how Ukraine's not a real country and the history of Russia, he signs that legislation and tells him to use the tomahawks.
Well, I agree with you 100%. It just goes to show this president has restored peace through strength. If you think about the failed Biden record on Ukraine and Russia, It was unilateral withdrawal of the sanctions on Nord Stream 2. It was the chaotic and disastrous retreat from Afghanistan, which invited aggression. It was months of Russian soldiers assembling at the border and not doing anything about it. And then after the further invasion of Ukraine, what did Biden do? He put sanctions on Russian banks. Yes, of course he did, but he issued a license that allowed Russian banks to process energy exports. Well, that's the whole economy of Russia. The record of Biden on Russia and Ukraine is one of weakness. What this president has done, especially by obliterating Iran's nuclear capacity, is to reassert peace through strength. He closed that loophole on sanctions. He's putting secondary sanctions on not only China, but also India for buying Russian energy. He's requiring more of our NATO allies, 5% of defense to GDP. So this president is actually taking this seriously. And I agree with you that the tomahawks would be further assistance to get the peace that the president wants.
Vladimir Putin wants Donetsk. He suggests he's not backing away from that. He wants all of it, even though after 14 years or 11 years, he's not gotten it. He can't win it on the battlefield. He's losing 1,000 a day, sometimes maybe a week. He's listening to over 1 million people. Listen to Zelensky on Meet the Press, Cut 4.
We are not losing this war, and Putin is not winning. And really, his army now in the weak position, I think so, because they really, from the beginning of this war, they could occupy 1% of our land. But they spend 1,300,000 people. I think this is high price.
And it looks like Ukraine is actually gaining land in certain areas.
They are.
And they're not getting. So this is, you know, they're saying, we'll give you Kherson. What, really? So you steal my stuff and then you're going to give me half of it back. I mean, this is crazy.
It is. And I think the agreement that the president negotiated, President Trump, to get American investors and mining companies into Ukraine to develop critical minerals. Well, this was an agreement that they negotiated. I think
that
needs to come to fruition because it would do two things. Number one, it'd help reimburse American taxpayers for the investment that we have made there with weapons and materiel to defend the freedom fighters in Ukraine. And secondly, it would create additional deterrence because it would have an American and NATO presence, economic interest in Ukraine going forward.
I think drones, too. I mean, drones are on the cutting edge. And word is, within 2 months, they're going to have enough for a drone shield. that could be knocking those Shahids out of the sky in a way that Russians aren't going to be able to adjust to for a while. So that could be up and running December, January. I mean, I'm sure the president gets this information. I just hope that Vladimir Putin is not convinced that he's going to be able to manipulate us.
You know, and I agree with you, but this is larger than just Vladimir Putin. This is also about Beijing. Beijing has been watching the West
yes.
in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. NATO needs to show resolve to send a message to Beijing with respect to Taiwan. And I think one of the most consequential actions taken by the current Trump administration in foreign policy was obliterating Iran's nuclear capacity and capability, because as our B-2 bombers were exiting Iranian airspace, all of our adversaries, not just Vladimir Putin, they recognized the exquisite capability of the United States Air Force and the fact that they were able to carry out that successful mission without anyone knowing about it.
Yeah, I mean, they show we will take action, and that leads to in the region, but no one deserves more credit even than Israel. What Israel has done with Hezbollah, it's stuff for spy novels, destroying Hamas the best they possible, and then minimizing Syria, thankfully, because Russia took their eye off the ball. It allowed Assad to be vulnerable. They get overturned. Iran loses an ally, and then they take direct action against Iran and show that Iran was totally infiltrated by Iranian forces. By Israeli forces.
Yeah, Israel obviously showed great courage and capability in what right. they've been able to do to defend their freedom, defend their democracy in the aftermath of October 7th. But it does show that this fool's errand of seeking sanctions relief, which is what Obama and Biden did with Iran, that was the wrong strategy. The right strategy to actually achieve peace and to diminish the terrorist threat from Gaza was to cut off the head of the snake, which were the mullahs in Iran and their ability to fund Hamas and Hezbollah.
Congressman Andy Barr is our guest. He's going to be running for the Senate in Kentucky. I want to bring you to Christine Lagarde. You know, she's the president of the European Central Bank. First off, she admitted that people overreacted to the impact of the tariffs, that they said it was going to rock the world economy, and it hasn't. To a degree. We're still trying to find out, but she admitted that they did overreact to that. But then she said this about the dollar on Face the Nation, cut 40.
I see signs that the attraction of the dollar is slightly eroded. And future will tell whether there is more erosion of that. But when you look at the rise of cryptos, number one, when you look at the price of gold, gold is typically, in any situation, the ultimate destination for safe haven. Price of gold has increased by more than 50% since the beginning of the year.
So you're on financial services, Congressman. What do you thought about what she said? Are you worried about the dollar eroding as the world currency?
So I'm not worried in the short term. What I will say is that if we continue the spending spree in Washington and we don't get our fiscal house in order, that's the greatest threat to the dollar's dominance and to our treasury markets. The reason why we have elevated treasuries, 10-year treasuries, is primarily because our debt is out of control. We've got to start living within our means, and then investors will invest more in treasuries. But I've met Lagarde, and I was actually visited the European Central Bank. I do agree, generally speaking, that the rise of cryptocurrencies could potentially pose a threat to the dollar's dominance. But what I would say is this: we are taking care of that in Congress, and with the president's leadership, we passed the Genius Act, mm-hmm. which creates a regulatory framework for dollar-backed stablecoins. So we're not following
Smart.
Christine Lagarde's lead. What she wants is a central bank digital currency in Europe for the euro. We're not doing that. That's a surveillance tool. Yeah. That's like copying what the Chinese are doing. What we are doing is we are creating the ability for dollar-backed stablecoins to get out into the global ecosystem and the global economy. That will solidify the dollar's dominance.
So through crypto, you can invest in the dollar.
That's right. Dollar-backed stablecoins.
Yes. All right. Thanks so much. Congressman Andy Barr, best of luck with getting back to work, ending this locked out, and with your Senate run.
Yeah, let's get the Democrats to start behaving responsibly, open up the government. We can negotiate all these issues after the government is open.
Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He aged, and right. He poked fun at it. We always owned up, and with age comes what happens when you get older.
Which is?
But when we talk about the mental acuity, and again, I take this very, very seriously. Yeah. I never saw anyone who wasn't there. I saw someone who was always engaged. I saw someone who understood policy, pushed us on the policy, and also understood history. And there were times, I'll tell you the story, there were times where he would call me into the Oval Office, and I would be like, oh no, because I knew whatever he was going to ask me was going to be direct, was going to be about a story he read, about how we're pushing back, how we're pushing a message forward.
So that is KJP. She wants us to believe he was so engaged and so detailed that she would be nervous when he got called into the Oval Office. You can't have Jake Tapper's book, the other accounts, the testimony, and have her account. And she's listed as one of his key advisors at the end. That's how scary it is, with absolutely almost no qualifications. She's his key advisor. And now she swears, as she has a book out, that he was engaged and I left the party because of the way he's been treated? Crazy. Insane. All right, we come back. Bear Grylls joins us. Famed survivalist, best known for his Discovery Channel show, Man vs. Wild, also Running Wild with Bear Grylls, author of a best-selling books in the past. He's got a new one, Greatest Story Ever Told, An Eyewitness Account, which was released in July. It's released again.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. With me in studio is a guy that can't be contained, but he has to stay in this studio just for today. Famed survival expert, best known for its Discovery Channel, Man vs. Wild. Also, Running Wild with Bear Grylls, author of several best-selling books, including The Greatest Story Ever Told, An Eyewitness Account, which was released back in July, but now it's getting the attention it deserves. And now you're in studio. Bear, great to see you.
Nice to be with you.
Now, there's a lot of people who think they have the greatest story ever told. What is the greatest story that you are telling in this book?
Yeah, so this is... So first of all, I still have my day job.
Right. You know, survivalist.
We've just finished filming season 9, Running Wild. Love all of that. That is kind of my day job. But I've always, through it all, had like a quiet Christian faith that has helped me through my life, through many jungles, deserts, mountains. And that's always been there. And I just kind of realized that so few people know the real story of Christ, you know, and myself included. We kind of grow up on stories, like we might have heard of the Nativity or the Crucifixion or the Good Samaritan, mm-hmm. you know. But the actual whole story is so mind-blowing and so revolutionary. And so
it's
sort of
only
beautiful.
2.5 years, right? That we know of? It's only 2.5 years.
Yeah, 3.5 years. Super short. But I realize out of all the millions of books written over the centuries, over the millennium, nobody's ever written the story of Christ start to finish as a thriller. Theologically accurate, but written as a thriller. You have the Bible,
right?
But people struggle to read the Bible. I struggle to read the Bible. And if you're not someone of faith, you're definitely going to not probably read the Bible. So I thought, let's do it, you know? And it's like, I've done lots of things in my life that people respond to, but I've never done anything that's come close to this. The response I get to this, I get people writing to me from every country, every culture, every faith, from Muslims to Hindus to writing to me going, I had no idea of the real story.
Well, how
of
do you
Jesus.
Know how do you know you have the real story? What were your sources?
The eyewitness accounts. So the greatest story ever told. And by the way, it's not the title isn't maybe the greatest story. You know, this if it's true, it changes everything because it affects how we live our lives, how we interact, our relationships, our confidence, our aspirations. And so we went back to the sources, and I write it from the five people that knew him best, from his mother to Thomas to Peter to John, and then eventually Mary Magdalene, very broken girl at the end, and write their responses. Why do the people who knew him best, everyday people, fight just to be close to him? Why would they wash his feet with tears of joy? Why would they fight to get through the crowd just to touch his cloak? And yet the religious elite fear this guy so much. And I went to Israel. I took a tent, a motorbike, and a parachute, and a couple of buddies. And we traveled through. This was like a few weeks before October the 7th. Took a parachute.
Oh, do you work,
because it's not an adventure without a paraglider and a parachute. Actually, I got to – that was a dream come true. You know, when I have to skydive a lot for my job, and I always get really nervous doing it. Ever since I broke my back in the military in a free fall accident, it's a hard thing for me to do. And I always, when I go out the door of that plane, I'm always like – I just quietly cross myself and go, be with me, you know, like help.
Yeah.
Just because I've like, it's, for me, it's hard to do.
I mean, for one thing, you've got to be saluted for doing something you fear and doing it anyway.
Well, it's the only way in life. It's like, otherwise, if you run the other way, the green monkey gets bigger on our back, you know. Anyway, the point of the story is I did get to do this. I'm looking at from a little plane, open the door, and I see the Sea of Galilee underneath me. And that was a dream come true, because I'm always saying, when I go out that door, be with me. So I actually kind of got to do that moment over the Sea of Galilee, which was quite cool.
Wow.
But my point is that journey, like, changed me in so many ways, you know, and I think we all grow up with such a sanitized version of Christianity. It's nice and smiley, and Jesus is meek and mild and white robes.
It's there to teach you the lessons of life, to give you rules to live by in order to have order in society.
And yet here was this guy who came to get rid of religion and to break so many rules and to bring life, and talked about living water and the bread of life, and was freeing people everywhere and healing people. And it's like, hold on, that guy is so different to what I grew up learning about kind of religion as such. And that's why, you know, we were chatting beforehand, you know, and you say, are you a sort of religious person, a Christian? So I kind of struggle with those words sometimes, because I don't know. For me, faith is kneeling down humbly, asking for Christ's help in our lives to give us strength for the everyday. You know, that to me is church. You know, I actually don't go to church very much. You know, that for me is my faith. And I try and keep it simple. And the goal of this book is to introduce people to the actual person of Jesus rather than just the religion around.
So you talk to the people that talk to him. Is Paul one of the people?
No. No. So this is just the closest eyewitness accounts. And, you know, it says on the back of the book, there is more, as it's a great Billy Graham quote. He said, there's more evidence that this story is true than there is that Julius Caesar ever even lived. You know, so we go right back to the sources, strip away all the religion. I don't change a single word that Jesus said through the sources of the New Testament. We write it as a thriller. I mean, somebody wrote to me the other day and said, this is like Tom Clancy's been tasked with writing the Jesus story.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I feel that's kind of, that's a compliment, but it's a good description. You know, it's like, why was it so radical? And here you go.
You said that Jesus drank.
For sure. I mean, like, you know, his first miracle was at a wedding with some friends in a little village, and they were partying and having a great time, and they run out of booze, and his mum sees a problem. And, you know, bear in mind, Jesus is 30 at this stage. And Mary's been told from the beginning that her son is going to be the son of God, you know, and she's kind of waiting. And she's the one nudging him, going, Jesus, they run out of booze. And he's kind of like, he says, it's not my time. You can almost imagine that's a line. Mum is not, but leave me alone. It's not my time. She goes, just do it. He goes again, it's not my time. And then eventually, it's a great interaction. People don't know about it.
Well, how did you know about it?
Because I read the Bible like four or five times
and also
to learn
out
all
the
of
people
it.
From the Chosen.
And we worked with these incredible theologians from the Chosen, and we stripped everything back and down. But eventually Mary just turns, she ignores Jesus. She turns to the servers and just says, do whatever he says. And he then he transforms, like, I think it's like 260 gallons of well water, boom, into wine. You know, so in terms of, like, I never realized Jesus was that sort of guy. You know, the Pharisees, the main accusation they had against him is that he was a glutton and a drunkard. That's not the Jesus I kind of like, you know.
I thought it's because they say that he claimed to be the Son of God, and that was blasphemy.
Well, that became ultimately why they wanted to kill him. But what they were so upset against initially is that he was hanging out with the lowlife and the everyday and the prostitutes and the tax collectors, the despised and the outcasts. And they're going, what are you doing? Why are you washing these people's feet?
And what's your answer to that? What did you find out?
Because he came to turn all of that stuff on his head and to say the kingdom of God belongs to everybody, not just the religious elite. There's nothing you can do to earn this. That's like why I say my faith is on my knees, head bowed, going, forgive me and help me today. Right. And my struggles be with me. Amen. You know, that is what, I mean, that's what Jesus means. It literally means he who saves. And that's a journey, because a lot of us like to do the earning in life. You know, we like to do our best and earn our way.
So why didn't he save himself?
Because he took our place. That's the beautiful bit. You know, of course he can. I mean, surely that's one of the great miracles. Why not? That's a thief on the cross next to him saying, mocking him, going, you saved others. You can't even save yourself. You know, if you're God, surely you can save yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But he was taking our place. And the guy I relate to most in all of the Bible, having read this thing, was the other thief on the cross on the other side, who says, do you have no respect? This guy has done nothing. We deserve to die. He's done nothing. And then he looks at Jesus and says, just remember me. And there's a beautiful bit where you can just imagine Jesus lifting his head up through the blood and spit and pain and suffocation of crucifixion, and looks at him and says, today you will be with me in paradise. And that's us on the cross. I like that, because I don't know a lot of the religious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I feel a little bit like the thief on the cross who just knows, like just remember me, be with me today.
Well, not anymore. Now you have to be one of the world's experts.
I don't feel like that. I don't feel like that. I really don't. I feel like I still feel at day one.
Well, for example, who chronicled that dialogue?
Which dialogue?
The dialogue
that's straight out of the Bible. That's straight out of eyewitness accounts, multiple eyewitness accounts.
Okay. And but like multiple people. Was Mary there?
Yeah, for sure. She was one of two women at the foot of the cross. In fact, everyone else had fled. You know, so his closest weren't even there.
So when people betrayed him, how does that fit into the story as you researched it? If they really believed who he was, why would they do that?
Because they were scared, and I love that. And it's like their humanness. I mean, I always, again, I'm coming at this fresh, so I'm no, like, expert. But what I learned is that, like, they were just, these disciples who fled, they were terrified, and they all couldn't understand. He kept saying, we're going to go out to Jerusalem, and I will be handed over, and I will be tortured, and then I will be killed for you. And it's like they kept thinking, maybe he's talking riddles. Maybe he's like, and then when it did happen, you're right, they fled. They're like terrified. And I kept thinking, I always had this image of all the apostles and, you know, these bearded, wise, great men. They were aged 15. 15 to 24. Matthew, Mark, Luke, Peter, you know, 15 to 23, they reckon.
Wow.
Was their average age. They were scared kids with little education from a backwater town up in the north.
But what I've also told by people is that if you want to be convinced, if you want proof, is how they changed after the resurrection. Because what they see 3 days later changed them, because then they realize this story is real and we're going to spend the rest of our life
telling. Something transformed them into now the greatest movement the world's ever seen in terms of a revolution of love that shaped our world for 2,000 years. But something happened. I mean, the interesting bit at the end of the book that people seem to really respond to is then I take through him what happened to each of those disciples. And every single one of them apart from one.
Don't give it away. Don't give it away. We'll have more with Bear Grylls. His book is now out. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Told, an Eyewitness Account, which is the life of Jesus really encompassing those 3.5 years. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
There's plenty of potassium in a goat's testicle and about 135 unadulterated calories. Well, that's definitely a first for me.
Got him.
And these are just fine to eat. Absolutely raw. And if I just grab the tail of this, give it a twist one way, twist the other way, should then just be able to pull out its guts. That's the stuff I don't want to eat. But then the rest of this is fine to eat. Not the head, but body's nice. Better cooked, but nice raw.
So set the scene, Bear Grylls. What was that about?
Well, I couldn't see it. All I can hear, of which my memory is, there have been an awful lot of those moments with a twist and a pull,
yeah,
and out come the guts and in go the rest of the crunch for some protein. So I don't know. That could have been, I couldn't see the pictures. Was it cricket or grasshopper or?
It was a shrimp? Okay.
Oh, sure. Well, that was one of the good ones.
Right. You don't care what you eat. You'll do anything. Because you got to survive.
I'm not like that in everyday life. But survival's not pretty. You need energy. You got to eat. You got to survive.
Who taught you this? Who taught you how to survive?
Well, my dad was a former Royal Marines commando. I mean, he died sadly too young, but he was just such a lovely dad and always taking me out, taught me to climb at a young age, loved the outdoor stuff. And then in the British Special Forces, after I left school, I joined the army, spent 4 years there. And my job there was the combat survival and all the climbing and the skydiving. So that's sort of where I refined it. And then ever since then, you know, we've been traveling and doing this job, you know, we've done hundreds and hundreds now of these adventures and episodes.
When did you realize this could be a great TV show?
I think that's probably still a work in progress. I don't think I necessarily feel it's that brilliant. I love my job. I love the crew we work with. It gets great recognition, and people are so kind about it. So I don't know. It's been a privilege. If I could have, you know, if you could speak to the 7-year-old me and say you can have a job that involves getting muddy and falling out of trees, right, and jumping off stuff, I would have thought, bring it on.
When you parachuted, what was the situation where you landed on the ground? Did the chute just not open?
Did open, but it had a tear in it, and I just came down really fast and broke my back in three places and had to leave the military, spent months in rehabilitation and tried to rebuild my life from the ground up, you know, and got a chance to, I mean, what I wanted to do again was to climb. You know, that became the whole focus of my recovery in hospital. I was going to be able to reach the bathroom across the room, and then I was going to reach the bathroom on the floor above, and I'd start smaller and I'd start to walk and then run and then climb. And the dream one day was to try and climb Everest. And I got to eventually be part of a small team of soldiers on that mountain. We had four climbers who lose their lives tragically up there, but two of us reached the top and changed my life
on
in so
your
many
trip,
ways.
Four people died on your trip in Mount Everest.
Yeah, two died of the cold, two fell.
Because we just had a whole group trapped on Mount Everest, like last week, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a big old dangerous mountain. You know, obviously more people climb it nowadays, and technology gets better, and forecasting gets better, and gear gets better. But it's still Mother Nature, and I think I've learned over a lifetime of that. When Mother Nature turns, it doesn't matter how big or brave or strong you are, you gotta respect it. Otherwise, it's gonna kick you hard.
How's your back today?
Like, always pretty sore, but you know what? I don't want to arrive at the end of my life in a perfectly preserved body. What a waste.
Right.
So, like, these are just reminders that life has been a great adventure and you got to keep living it, facing forward, front foot forward, all in, be a never give upper, and a few scrapes and scratches, scars and backaches.
So,
part of the journey.
So Bear Grylls had this project. He wanted to tell the story of Jesus, and he wanted to see it through the people that knew him. And it's all in this book called The Greatest Story Ever Told. So how long did it take you until you put it into writing into a book? And what was the publisher's reaction when you told them that you wanted to do this?
Well, it was quite a long process because you got to get it right. This one you can't screw up. You know, you're telling the story of our Lord.
At least you have to be earnest.
So we worked with an incredible team of theologians on this, and actually we ended up like rewriting it about four or five times over. But at the end, it stands up, and I get even theologian professors writing to me from around the world, and I'm always like nervous to open their mail. But every time they go, good job. So it's and at the end of the day, the story is timeless. The story was he was changing lives every day around him 2,000 years ago. And the story when people encounter the real story today, it changes lives left, right, and center. And I see it. And I feel this book is actually no longer my book. I feel it's like got a life of its own there. It's out there now. And like I said, the response has been unlike anything I've ever had before. I'd give up every Emmy and Everest Summit and all these sort of things in a heartbeat just to have done this one.
All right, Bear, I'm sure it's going to continue to sell incredibly well. Pick it up. Greatest story you ever told, especially with Christmas just around the corner. What better story to tell, right? An eyewitness account. Bear, thanks so much. Appreciate it. You can follow him at Bear Grylls, G-R-Y-L-L-S. Thanks, Bear. Great to see you.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Kilmeade Show.